It is July 24th, 2010, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
It's time now, of course, for Geekspeak.
Hey, Lyle.
Good morning. My name is Lyle Troxell. This is Geek Speak on KOSP Santa Cruz. In the air with me is Miles Elam. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
And over the internet via Skype is Alex Lias. Good morning, Alex. Let me unmute Alex. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning, Lyle.
Alex, what's your title today?
Today, I am still just an application security analyst. You can call me your Southern California correspondent if you like. I'm actually fulfilling that role today.
Yes, from LA. Thank you very much. Well, from Southern California. Thank you
very much. Well, you do in general. You're actually active support for us. You look up stuff and you call us out on items and stuff like that. People, the audience should know that Alex is actually behind the scenes a lot of our shows, that he'll be on the chats and he'll be helping us out, even though he doesn't get the credit and the glory of being on air all the time.
That's right. All right, so GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of online tonight with David Lawrence. I normally do that at the end of the show. And also, anything you hear on GeekSpeak, the views expressed are those of us, but not of KOSP. I think that's the official title. And GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. After today's show and on Sunday, join the car guys, Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers, for their advice on things automotive and just about everything else on Car Talk every Sunday and Saturday at 9 a.m. right here on Central Coast Public Radio. All right, let's do news. And Miles, I think we'll start with you, sir.
Okay. Exciting news in the alternative energy front, or renewable energy front, I should say, which is that the first molten salt solar plant has come online and is producing power even at night.
So what do you mean molten salt?
The idea behind this plant is it's not a photovoltaic, like many people think of solar power. Mm-hmm. It's not converting sunlight directly to electricity. What's happening instead is that it is acting like most other power plants in that it generates steam, which turns a turbine. But it needs to generate, but it needs heat for this. And so instead of photovoltaics, which require a clean room and are fairly expensive and they sometimes use rare materials, they have set up a large number of mirrors. And they all focus, basically all the land area ends up being this...
collector.
Yeah, a parabolic mirror that goes up to a single point and superheats it.
It's like Bond movie had this. Alex, remember which Bond movie had this as like one of the core features?
I can't remember.
I remember there was a electromagnetic pulse that was being.
This is an earlier Bond movie. They've got a solar collector like that, and he's inside the room and he's trying to take this device, which is actually the thing that collects all the light. Totally different than the way, except the mirrors are all the same. And he's trying to turn off the collector so that the beam of energy that's hitting it turns off. And a cloud and he's got like somebody upstairs, and he's like, "Turn it off," and the beam goes off, but a cloud has gone over. So he preaches his hand and he pulls it back out and the beam comes back on with obliterated. Very Bondian thing. Anyway, this is a little different. Instead of actually having a highly good photovoltaic, which is the sci-fi in that movie, instead you're heating up, I'm assuming, salt.
Right. It's the fact that you sodium is really useful in that it stays liquid at a very wide operating range. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's not going to vaporize until it gets much hotter than what this would work at.
Are we just talking table salt?
No. Table salt is sodium chloride. I'm talking about elemental sodium.
Okay.
Very different thing, which has its own set of issues. Like, for example, you don't ever want to have elemental sodium exposed to air and especially not water.
Because it's highly volatile.
Yes, it is explosive, as a matter of fact. But
okay, so you've got this sodium, and it's superheated.
Right. They get it to over 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And at this point, it's acting as a moderator, as it were. So you don't have to just generate the power that's directly attributed to the sun. You can start collecting that heat. And so what they've done is after the sun goes down, you still have all of that heat. It has very low specific heat where it keeps all that heat. And that's that residual heat is what's, you know,
they're using to generate electricity.
That's what you're turning the turbine with.
Right. So I'm assuming, so the way you generate electricity in like a coal plant and pretty much any power plant is you heat something up, turn it into steam, and then run a turbine from it.
Right.
So a nuclear power plant, you heat up the water with that in that source, and then you force it through a turbine. The turbine spins. It's just like a giant motor or generator, which are electronically the same. And then that's how the electricity comes out. So what you're saying is with one of these, you're heating a material, probably a lot of volume of this super hot stuff, and then you run your water through it to heat it up. And when the sun goes down throughout the night and even in cloudy days, you still have a giant heat mass which you're generating your power from.
Right.
That's pretty cool.
Now, something to note about this is that it's 30,000 square meters of mirrors.
I'm sorry?
30,000 square meters.
Can you give me... So we're talking a lot of miles.
As a square... I'll figure out what size it is.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a lot of square miles.
What? No, I don't know that it is, actually.
30,000... Oh, wait.
Yeah, square meters.
That's 30 square kilometers,
no,
right?
No. We're talking about square meters. We're talking about an area, not a length.
Okay. All right.
So
yeah,
go on.
Think about that math.
And it's looking to produce a capacity of 5 megawatts, and it cost this prototype cost about 60 million euros. Now, the thing about this, by the way, it's in Sicily, so just offshore from mainland Italy. The thing about this, though, is 5 megawatts. Like, I hope that this is just a prototype, because 30,000 square meters for 5 megawatts, we'll see how that works out. To give a point of reference, a Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant has a couple of reactors there. Mm-hmm. Just one of the reactors gives you 1,100 megawatts.
Right.
But at the same time, it costs a lot more than 60 million euros. So I'd be curious to find out what that – so what you have to look at there is also like, okay, so how – what's the difference in the materials that you have to do? What's the maintenance costs? What's the pricing difference per unit of energy? And what's the land area use?
Right.
So if you're multiplying 5 megawatts by 30,000 square meters to get to the numbers where you're working on a level that Americans are used to, you're going to start talking about large volumes of land.
Right. Cool.
But it's still a useful thing to talk about, though.
Yeah, and I like the idea that it can keep working for a period of time. I'm assuming it has a run time of after it has sunlight for more than, you know, 20 hours.
Right. As long as they can keep the salt, isolated.
Right.
And as long as, you know, the mirrors can be kept clean. That probably will be the biggest issue, keeping the mirrors clean.
I love the idea of taking what we traditionally think of as an energy source and using another thing to store it. Like in this situation, they're storing their energy in heat, in metal. Mm-hmm. And then there's this great story about manipulable buses, and I'm not sure if they're still doing this, where they have giant flywheels of mass. And as the bus system, as the bus breaks, you know, slows down, it actually transfers that inertia into a spinning inertia. And then when it wants to take off again, it takes the flywheel energy back.
Right.
Never leaving inertial mass, which is really cool.
Right. Just one problem with those. My dad actually worked on some of those systems, trying to get them to work. And they were really great as long as you never wanted to turn. because the flywheel ended up having
turning
a gyroscopic
effect. No problem.
Started having a very strong gyroscopic effect.
Right, and then it's always a 90-degree difference of turn. So if you've got your flywheel going horizontal and you try to turn, your bus is going to fall over. That's very cool. All right. Thank you, Miles, for that wonderful story about using sodium in the sun. And yeah, cool.
So I did the math real quick. Size of the mirror is actually about 7.5 acres.
Yeah, that's a lot of space. Yeah,
7.5 acres, that's still
doable.
It's
not huge. Yeah, no,
that's
totally doable.
Considering what you're talking about with power plants, they're taking land areas. And you have to...
Well, I'm sure Diablo uses more land than that just for the security purposes.
Right.
And it's coastal land.
You have that, and you have, like, even coal and natural gas, you have to have some area in that land around it that is going to be dedicated to it, even though you don't have a structure on it. So.
Right. Okay, cool. Thanks. Alex, news story, sir?
Sure. Let's see. So recently, and this is not just in the last week or so, but fairly recently, I've been gone for a while, so I'm still catching up on news. Mm-hmm. But Microsoft has opened up their source code to the Russians, it seems. not necessarily to the bad guy Russian mafia or anything like that. It is the Russian Secret Service, the FSB. And they open it up so that they can do some review of the software and kind of do their own security assessment for Windows 7 specifically. It's Windows – I'm sorry, not Windows 7. It's Windows Server 2008 Release 2 and also the Microsoft Office 2010 and their SQL Server. So some key pieces of software, some of the leading stuff that's out there for servers. Personally, I don't really have a huge amount of trust that not necessarily, trust in the FSB or the Russian government, but that they can maintain the security with as much corruption as we know exists over there. So there's a bit of a concern that the mafia, Russian mafia and other organizations, crime organizations will get their hands on this. It'll be interesting to see
Would it be really beneficial?
Happens.
I mean, the reason, of course, as a security expert, the reason you're aware of the Russian mafia is that a lot of hacking and stuff seems to be sponsored by Russian-speaking people, right?
Also not just Russian-speaking people, but people that have been identified as part of various organized crime in Russia.
Okay, so it's pretty attached to organized crime in Russia. So you're saying that – and they make a lot of virus stuff, right?
Oh, yeah. Exploits for certainly.
Computer. Would getting source code – help? Sorry, Miles, what were you going to ask?
I was actually going to mention, is this really an issue just because I remember years ago, Lyle, your common boss, Dan Wang, was talking about working at Disney, and Disney had the source code to Windows NT. Microsoft gave it to them, and so there were all these development groups that had access to the full Windows operating system source code because they were doing really interesting stuff and pushing some limits. And they were paranoid. They wanted to know what was going on. and so any one of those people that had access to the source code or, access to a laptop that had that source code would be able to give it off to organized crime. So does this actually step up the threat level that much?
Not that much for those environments. Here we're talking specifically about Windows Server 2008 their SQL Server source code, so that's more server centric. But at the same time, it's not necessarily worse than that because they did have it fairly open to a lot of people. I don't know what their controls were, their background checks were, for Disney or other organizations that they opened that sort of thing up to. But it's in my eye one step closer to certain groups that we know are part of a lot of crime or specifically internet-based attacks and stuff. So I don't know if it'll be worse, but I think there's probably more connections with Russian or just Eastern Bloc organized crime groups within the Russian government, I think.
Okay, so back to my question. Do you think that if you're writing viruses and vulnerabilities to infect people's machines and be able to steal their identity or use their machines for spamming. Do you think having the source code of Windows is a helpful thing?
It's just a little bit helpful to know how it works.
We're looking at how
vulnerabilities occur.
Right. I'm only asking because it seems to be so it's so effective to write them without the source code, it seems to me, that it's kind of surprising that, you know what I mean?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's effective to write them without the source code, but that's still doing a lot of reverse engineering. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of more effort that has to go into that. If you have the source code, you don't have to do all that extra work for reverse engineering. You can literally see, here's how the code's going to work. Oh, look, there's a vulnerability. You can run tools against it. You can do all sorts of things when you have the source code that you would not be able to do if you didn't.
Okay, so thank you very much, Alex. So since we're talking about Microsoft, at least in Microsoft news, on Thursday, Microsoft released their numbers for the second quarter. And they sold, supposedly, 25 million copies of Windows 7's licenses in the last 29 days of that quarter. So last month, basically, 25 million copies. That's and they say 175 million since the launch of this Windows 7. That is 10 copies of Windows 7 every second over the last month. That's pretty good, huh?
I mean, that's a lot of Windows.
That's a lot of Windows. That's a drafty house.
That's a lot of OEM sales.
That's what I was thinking too. So describe that, Miles.
Whenever they have deals with Dell and HP, HP Compact, things like that, organizations like that.
That make hardware.
Right. And so the system comes with an operating system, and usually that's going to be Windows-based. And for a long time, they were dragging their heels because customers were saying, I don't want Vista, I want XP.
Mm-hmm.
But now Windows 7 appears good enough, a step up from Vista and XP, from what I hear. And so you end up with making that transition, which means that all of those machines that were being sold with XP or sold with Vista are all now migrating to Windows 7.
Right. So, and when you say block. That's a lot of sales of OEM, they could sell 10 million copies to Dell easy, like overnight, right? So whether...
In fact, it would happen overnight,
right.
Which is...
It would just be a purchase.
Which is the numbers you would see.
Right.
That's what you're seeing at that quarter. In 29
right.
days, that's the changeover for all those OEMs.
And I'm curious what it would be for, over a period of a year. That's the real telling of how much. And then the other question I was kind of thinking about this is that I've got old OEM Windows disks that I don't know if I ever used. Like, they came with machine, I installed a newer OS or I installed a different OS. So to me, it's not necessarily how many machines are running it. It really is how much potential is there is. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah. Chances are if you buy a PC, you are running Windows, though.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's 99% chance.
Definitely. All right. Well, thank you very much, Miles. And that was me. And now let's go back to Alex. Wait a second. We just did the cover. Now it's Miles' turn. Sorry, Miles. What's going on with the... Well,
since I'm talking about renewable energy, I'll continue along that bent.
Sounds good.
Before we were talking about solar power, now we're talking about wind power. Except this one had a bit of a wrinkle. Before, I was talking about solar power and issues with making sure that you can make enough power. Oregon actually has the reverse problem. They have a whole bunch of wind power that's making too much electricity.
It doesn't seem like a problem, but go on.
On May 19th in the afternoon, the wind speeds went up so high that of all the wind farms that were out there, they were pumping down too much electricity for the grid to handle.
Wow.
It was a huge power surge. And they and the grid managers had to tell all of the operators out there, you need to feather the blades. In other words, you need to have the blades so they're not the most efficient. Yeah. Yes, you can. It's similar to in an airplane, the speed of the propeller is not all there is to it. You also twist the propellers somewhat to get more or less pull from them.
I did not.
For
I knew
efficiency.
That was in a case in helicopters. I didn't know about props. So basically you're changing the angle of attack of the propeller blades, and therefore you get
exactly
a different amount of lift translated into.
But almost always with wind, you're trying to find the most efficient you can to get it going.
What,
and
what happens when you oversaturate a grid? I mean, is it the voltage rise? I guess.
I actually don't know.
Because
that
I
would
thinking,
be a great question to ask someone who does know. If someone out there does, please call in.
I would assume the voltage would start spiking because you're not going to produce. I mean, current's an availability of power. It's really interesting. I wonder how that works at a large scale. Because in a small circuit situation, if you've got more current, it's not a problem. It's just a storage medium. But you're always thinking about it's an interesting problem. Basically, the less storage, the less current you need, the less inductance occurs because you're not drawing as much. That's really interesting.
Yeah. When you start talking about a municipal level, though, like,
I know,
all of our numbers
starts getting. It's one of those things where the concepts that I have that work at a circuit level all of a sudden just go too large and it doesn't make sense.
Right. Like I could write a web server.
Yeah.
And it would actually work pretty well, but it's not going to be on the same level as something like an Apache.
Right.
You know, it's
interesting. Okay, I got to kind of look that up and see what happens. But I'm assuming the voltage levels spike on everybody's lines, which wouldn't be good. Of course, then there's limiters that are going to shut it off, so it would probably basically turn off the grid. But I don't know.
Which would also be bad.
Yes,
you also have to be aware of how fast those blades are turning, because, I mean, there's a physical component to having these things spin that can also cause them to rip themselves apart if they're not, you know, if there's too much wind.
That can
be a problem too.
I'm sure they're designed pretty high.
Well, that's one of the reasons why they have the feathering on that.
They can slow down
on the
prop
so that they can deal with that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, thank you for the kind of good news in Oregon. Too much electricity just doesn't seem like a problem, but okay. What they should do is
anything is a problem when you talk about municipal or you know, large scale energy production, large scale of anything.
You know,
is
if
going
they had a
issues.
Whole bunch of sodium, they could just heat it up and store the energy there. Big toasters.
Wait, hold on. You're converting mechanical energy to electrical energy to convert to thermal energy to convert back into electrical. Yeah, I don't see any
if
losses there.
If you've got
there.
Too much.
And then eventually we're going to just power fans and put it back into wind energy.
Because of people's houses and they turn on their air conditioners. What? All right. Actually, okay. Thank you very much, Miles, for that. What's up with console games versus PC games, Alex?
All right. Well, this is partially based on rumor, but it's a good article I had read out there about a project that Microsoft had running, and this project was mostly to kind of take some of the best console gamers and some of the best PC gamers for the same game. So games that are where people are playing on their consoles, like the Xbox or the PlayStation, etc., and then games where they're playing on their personal computer with a keyboard and a mouse and all of that. And it turns out that, partially rumor, that the results were that PC gamers pretty much destroyed the console gamers. It doesn't surprise me. I've always favored playing on a computer. I can't stand playing certain games on consoles. You just don't have the control, the subtle movements of a mouse compared to trying to move a little joystick with your thumb. It's a bit of a difference.
Or the fact that you have a full keyboard in front of you.
Yeah, a full keyboard with, tons of controls to quickly switch weapons, etc. You know, so there's just a lot more control, and so it doesn't surprise me, but I guess Microsoft went and scrapped this project. Don't know their exact reasons, but I'd say it has something to do with the Xbox consoles that they have an investment in. And then they probably didn't care for the results of showing that, it's better to play a game, or it gives you more control over a game to play on the computer. A lot of people that are talking about it say that, it's kind of sucks because it could have been a boost for PC gaming, which is going downhill. And it's sad because the thing that provides it depends on your personal preference, I guess, but to me, play provides the better experience, the better control, the ability to do better in a game is declining, and it's moving towards a console despite the fact that the better experience is on the PC.
Hmm. Now, you're talking about better experiences, better performance ability. That's
yes.
Not necessarily better experience. I mean,
true.
The one thing that I don't play as much video games in my Windows machine is it takes a whole time to kind of start it up, get the updates going. You know, I get to this point where I'm just not playing games because I don't want to deal with the timeline of kind of setup. When you got a console, you power it up and it's working. So there is a benefit in that sense. I mean, I think that's why they're so popular. Of course, they're cheaper too on the long run, unless you're using your Windows machine for other purposes. But it's curious to me that the performance is even that much better. I get that the interface of a thumb, a thumb pad or a joystick pad isn't as good necessarily as a mouse, but I'm surprised because I've seen some really great performance out of people using, a joystick. Well, what are those called now? Not a D-pad. The USB controller, effectively. Miles, can you play any good on those? I mean, I know you play well on a mouse. You're pretty trigger happy on a mouse.
Well, no.
The other thing I was wondering is that the resolution on a Windows on a desktop machine is normally better too. And for a shoot 'em up game, having good resolution is really important.
For the screen, you mean?
Yeah.
Things became much more into parity when you started hitting the HD games, when you had a TV that's 1080p, you know, playing on a PS3.
Even if the resolution's not that good, the pixels are so much larger, it's easier to see, possibly. Target far away. Fascinating, cool. And, of course, this is just rumor, right?
Yeah, it's mostly based on rumor for the project and all.
And
I mean,
to be clear,
I don't know if it's necessarily considered rumor that PC gamers are going to be able to play better than a console gamer, but that could just be opinion.
And to be clear, console game we're talking about is like a Wii or an Xbox 360 or a PlayStation, right? These are systems that are designed just to play games and media centers versus a desktop computer or even a laptop computer that you'd use for other purposes, a multi-purpose computer.
I wish there was more details about the actual testing that they did, because, sure. I mean, with the consoles, you can play with a keyboard and mouse nowadays, and I'm wondering if that was even taken into consideration.
Right. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Henry J. Ramirez DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry and using digital technology for less radiation and offering one-appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. This is GeekSpeak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Miles Elam, and via Skype is Alex Salias. And we're taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, that's 831-476-2800. Or you can call us toll-free, 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. Do either of you have a quick mention for a geek bit?
Unfortunately, I don't.
That's because we don't have Al. We're just not prepared. Bummer. All right. The console game story was Alex's, which means we'll go to Miles about editorial.
Yeah, just a quick thing about bias. Just because last week ended up being a little acrimonious near the end of the show, talking about stuff, and I wanted to acknowledge that we have our own biases. Everyone has their own biases as human beings. We believe certain things. We have certain tendencies, to go toward one solution rather than another.
When you say think of an animal, I almost always think of a land-based animal, even though there's probably more animal life in the sea. It's a bias.
Something like that, yeah.
Like that. Simple things, but also complex things.
And the thing is, there are a lot of things that just come down to opinion. And then you have the questions are, wait, who is right? Because there's only one world that we live in, and we both have an argument about the world that we live in. Mm-hmm. For example, if you or I were standing out by the beach and pick up a rock, and I say, if I let go of this rock, it's going to fall to the ground. And you say, no, it's not. It's going to hang in the air. That's not necessarily an opinion anymore. That's getting into...
But it hasn't happened, so we don't actually know until it happens.
Right.
So it's predicting the future, which we know is not very valid most of the time. So we could have a large
argument.
Right,
we are working with empiricism. We're saying that the world is going to work in the future as it has in the past.
Right. But if I take on the perspective that it's not going to fall to the ground, you'd pretty much think I was lying to you. Like, you wouldn't believe that I thought that.
Right. And it isn't because I think... Because... You might retort, wait, what do you mean? It's just, what do you mean it's going to fall? I think it's going to hang up in the air. I'm saying, no, it can't hang up in the air. And hypothetically, you might say back to me, well, do you know everything about gravity? Do you know everything about rocks?
Right.
Well, no, I don't know everything about rocks and gravity. Well, then how do you know it's not going to hang up? It's not a fair question to make.
Right.
It's saying, well, we can always test it. So I'm going to let it go. And wait a second, the rock stays up in the air. Oh, wait, look, someone has a string attached to it and they're hanging it from above and we can see that it hasn't really, broken it. So we have these biases, but we can test them. We can look at them and evaluate them. It's mm-hmm. not just about opinion. And one of the things we can do also is say, oh, the person that we're testing, let's say someone has a divining rod. And people say, like, well, it totally works. If you have a barrel full of water, I walk over to it and the divining rod, makes it.
Divining rod is two rods bent at a 90-degree angle that you hold in your hand and the long part goes out directly.
Or they may be the same size, whatever, but they intersect with one another. They cross when you're holding them in your hand. And you can give that divining rod, or the two divining rods, one in each hand, to someone who doesn't believe that it exists. and have them walk toward that barrel of water, and they will cross. It's actually a phenomenon called the ideomotor effect, something that we were talking about at the Skepticism Conference at TAMA. And so the question is not whether or not that happens, even with someone who doesn't have anything invested in it. What you have to do is make sure the person who's doing it doesn't know where the water is. So you have five barrels. And you
if
test,
were to
see,
test this.
Right. And test it to see if does it cross for just the two that it has water in, or does it cross for any of the three that have sand in them?
Now, let's say if I did have barrels on the beach and you didn't know which one was in and I was watching you. The other thing that's interesting is that you can pick up on what I'm thinking and feeling by my body posture and things. Things are so subtle that we might not even know. And therefore, if I know when I'm standing near the barrels, you might actually pick up, subconsciously even, on where the water is.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing, exactly. and then the ideomotor effect would kick in, kind of informing your body to cross the
Yeah, if
the
I didn't like you, would or if you didn't like me, it would be like, oh, there's a disappointment. Oh, it must be here. It's going to work. Or, right. Oh, hey, it's going to, you know, someone's and eyes
that,
widen.
And that's why actually we do a double blind test. That
right.
This
is, we are talking about blinding here. Mm-hmm. The first one where I didn't know where the water is and where there was sand is called a blind, a single blind. If the tester doesn't even know, if someone else rigs up the barrels and says, okay, this one, you know, number one has water, number two has sand, number three has water, number four has sand, you know, that type of thing, and make sure that they're the same weight and then places them out and then says, okay, you who doesn't know where everything is at, you're testing, and you who doesn't know where anything is at, you're the one who's grabbing
right,
the mining
and the tester
rod.
Only writes down what number barrel that the person detected, but right. Doesn't write down, they don't know where it is. Okay.
Right. And what you're doing there is you're removing bias. That's the sole purpose to that exam is to, or that item is to say, we're going to take away any idea that we have, or any pre-existing ideas about whether or not it works or not. And we're taking away any possibility of bias, the ideomotor effect, anything like that, in medicine, the placebo effect, just to see, does this actually work
right
in our world that we share together? So there's only one possible answer in this case.
All right, that's where you bring back all of the
right
one possible answer. Okay.
And so all of that we were just discussing can be referred to by a very common name. We use it all the time.
Is it science?
The scientific method.
Cool.
So when someone says a scientific method, they're not saying, oh, we're going to bring our Bunsen burners and we're going to bring out Big Pharma and we're going to bring out, you know, the establishment of NASA, you know,
something like that. It's not mysterious. It's complicated to actually take out the bias.
And it's not a collection of knowledge, although we have gathered a great deal of knowledge from it.
What you're saying is science is not a collection of knowledge.
Right. Science is not a collection of knowledge. It is a process.
It's a methodology.
Right. And so when we talk about, this wouldn't work according, you're not using scientific principles. Oh, yes, it is science. Like, no, because what you're describing to me is not following that method to remove your bias.
Well, and here's another example of the barrel water dowsing thing. If you did that, you actually couldn't do it with just one person because there's going to be, you don't know if they get the barrel wrong or if you get the barrel right, you don't know if it's chance. So what you have to do is you have to do it 100 times and see if that chance of picking the one in five barrels is slightly above. Right. And if it is enough above and the test looks like it's valid and you then take that test and you submit it to journals and say, this is what we did. These are our results. And then if there is a figure there going, hey, there's an unknown. Why would this happen? And it's curious. Another group of people will try it again, maybe using the same way you did it or a different way of doing it, trying to see if what the conclusions you came up with worked again so that we can see repetitivity. You know, we can see that
right.
They're
going to be checking your methods, checking to see, well, how did you do that? Wait a second.
You didn't comb the sand after you laid the barrels down? Well, the water barrel is going to take more time to place, so there's going to be more footprints around the water barrel. Like, there's a lot of methodology in every single test, and if you don't account for it and if you don't repeat it and if it's not something that other people can do, you're not sure if it's bias.
It's all about bias. So right. We're going to take away any crazy language and say, how do we remove the bias?
Right. And so when we talk about studies on this show and most shows, when you talk about a study, the study is the entire process and the output that comes out of it. And you don't know if it's any good. Like, there's a lot of analysis that needs to come along. So that's the curious thing is that we talk about studies and we go, well, is it a good study? That's what we mean, right? Was it good science?
Right.
Is it valid? Do you know?
And most of the time, you don't know in a particular area of knowledge, whether it be theoretical physics or medicine or, you know, chemistry or the like. Chances are the only people who would be able to really evaluate that source paper are people who are also PhDs in that particular area.
And this is the sand analogy at the beach, you know, beach and the barrels and the water and the sand is a great one for that. If you have people looking at it that have never been to a beach, they might not think about the footprints in the sand,
mm-hmm.
right? You have to have someone that has a knowledge of the environment you're testing it. You have to have knowledge of how the – even down to the potentials of – like if you didn't know that the motor effect works, the idiomotor mm-hmm. effect, that your muscles work kind of on their own without you consciously being aware of it, you wouldn't know that would be a possibility of to test for that.
Right. And if you wanted to test for whether or not someone could douse, you'd want to ask someone who says, yes, I can douse. I am a professional douser. And you'd want to have them involved in the study. You don't want to exclude them.
That's right.
But you also don't want to tell them where the water is and in which barrel.
All right.
And with all of that, that's how we gain knowledge, to be able to find out stuff about our world. It's not about an opinion.
And it gets tricky. I mean, a lot of studies of different things are the money is put up by a company or a group that's mm-hmm. going to benefit from it. Drug studies are a perfect example of this, right? You've got a company that wants to sell a drug to the population, and they're going to put forward they want to put the drug, but they got to get a test, and they got to get positive results. They want it to work, of course, because if it works, then they get to sell the drug better. But they put a lot of money into seeing if it's going to work. And if the theory that it's going to work is happening, they want to make sure that it happens. So you get this really tricky situation where the funding's coming in. You need to have scientists that are not biased, but of course they're making money from the
scientists that are using the proper methodology. Scientists are human beings, so they are going to be biased, and that's why they're using the scientific method to try to reduce that bias as much as we know how to.
Which, of course, is very hard to do because we're smart, motivated, biased individuals.
Right.
Well, it's also good to note is, you know, it's important to in doing these retrying or be able to reproduce the experiments that are done or the studies that are done, is you're not just being able to rule out bias, but if there is discrepancy between one test and another test, it helps because you can then identify, well, maybe there's more variables at play that were not accounted for originally. And that's where you can start refining the study and at least understanding more of what's going on in this reproduction. And then you rule for that. And then you can, reproduce the test and verify whether or not those variables come into play.
Right. Yeah. And you're also talking that comes into play quite a bit with studies where a preliminary study happens and it doesn't have a lot of output except to say, is there a possibility of something happening here? Right. And then a preliminary study really just kind of says, should we study this in mass? Like, that's all it really is about. But people will take a preliminary study and go, there's something happening here. Well, not exactly. The sand example is a perfect example. We might do the study without the sand, the footprints, right, in the sand, and you might get a high turnover, right? But reality, if you do the test again and you do it on a flat surface, that completely goes away, and then it's random again. You won't know that unless you do a study at a higher level.
Right. And if you have something like dowsing, mm-hmm. where you're making a claim, I can find water with this, that's a testable claim. Therefore, it is within the realm of science.
Sure.
If you say homeopathy makes people feel better,
mm-hmm.
it cures X, Y, or Z, that is a testable claim. And if you are in some area or you subscribe to some belief that says people have been discounting me and saying, you know, that this doesn't work, but I've seen it work. I believe it works. Something like homeopathy, something like
or
dowsing, something like, yeah, or except aspirin is generally accepted. It has tested methodology behind it. But if you believe that you're getting you're not getting a fair shake, mm-hmm. if we're totally, you know, shutting you down without giving you a fair shake, the James Randi Educational Foundation has a $1 million prize. If using the double-blind study experimental item that we were talking about earlier, under those conditions, if you're willing to go under those conditions, and you can show that it works.
Something that we don't understand right now in science.
Right, something that we don't understand how it works. Not only will you win the Nobel Prize.
Of course.
Because you were saying this is something that our current knowledge of physics says is not possible. But you will also be getting $1 million from the James Randi Educational Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And they have offered this fund for many years, and no one has successfully claimed it.
And keeping in mind that, you know, when Miles says winning the Nobel Prize because you're showing something that people didn't know before, that's why Einstein won the Nobel Prize, right? Because mm-hmm. he thought of something that other people didn't accept and said, this is what's going on, testing it. Sure enough, it's true. Nobel Prize. Like, the way we discover new things are in the world in some sense and get them understood is by doing good science. And when new things happen, it definitely changes our perspective.
If someone says, oh, people aren't going to study this, there's a cabal that's stopping us from getting into the mainstream or to have people look at this. If you can prove that homeopathy works, you will win the Nobel Prize in medicine that year. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no doubt, and possibly the Nobel Prize in physics.
Right. But you've got to do it at a point that removes all bias, which means you have to do good science.
Right.
All right, let's move on. John from Santa Cruz, what's going on with your DVD player? Hi, John.
Hi. It's actually one of those little ones on like 9-inch screens that have a battery inside of it.
Portable DVD player, sure.
Right. And when I bought it, the battery worked fine, and then it started to die, and then it just died right out. And for years, it's not worked. And I check it pretty regularly, actually, because I just was curious about it. One day, I turned it on, and I noticed that it wasn't plugged in, and for a full hour and a half, the battery worked. And I've tried doing it since then. I've tried charging it different ways in terms of having it on, having it off, having it playing, you know.
And the battery doesn't work?
And now it's not doing it anymore. And it actually did start to do it again the other night. I got about half an hour out of it. How
now, when you're saying it's plugged, when you're saying it's
regenerating.
Sure. When you're saying it's plugged in or unplugged, are you talking about the plug that goes actually into the unit or the part of the plug that goes into the wall?
The jack going into the unit.
Okay. Sometimes those units only work when that's unplugged, right? The jack itself is unplugged. It turns on and off the battery based on that. You're sure that that's not the issue?
Right.
Okay, so what you're talking about is a unit where you can't you plug it in the wall, you let it be for a long time, you unplug the power from the back of the unit, it doesn't work. You do it again, you do it again, you do it again. Battery never seems to keep a charge. And then every once in a while, all of a sudden the battery's keeping a charge.
It's only happened basically, I'll say only once.
Okay, so there's a few different possibilities of what's going on, but my assumption is that the detection circuitry in this unit, that whether the battery is functional or not, is faulty. That's what I would guess. So there's actually a lot of complexity in trying to get a rechargeable battery to function effectively on a unit like that. You don't want the voltage to drop to a certain level, right? So you want as a battery runs out, the voltage level lowers down. If you've got a DVD player doing this, you're going to get odd behavior that's going to be not user-friendly. So there's normally circuitry that says if the voltage goes down too low, just disable the battery. Basically turn off the unit, right? So it's kind of a shutdown sequence.
Right.
It's very possible that the circuitry that's doing that detection is faulty. So your battery's fine, but the actual little probably Zeno diode that actually determines the voltage level or the transistor that does the switching is the value on that is one of those is a little wonky. And so what you get is a bad detection that the battery's bad.
And oh, wow. So the battery might still be actually good.
The battery could be fine, right. The other thing is that all that circuitry that does that actually has thermal differentiation. So it effectively it runs differently depending on the temperature that it's in. So if you've charged it for a long time, the circuitry is going to be really hot, right? And then if you try it then, it's going to be at a hot state and therefore the detection might be super high or super low. It might be wrong a little bit, right? And then later on, if you try the unit and it's cooled off a whole bunch, it's going to be different. But also the room temperature. So if you're skirting that kind of strange space with a bad circuit and you're in this variable area where temperature is going to affect the circuit, it's kind of unpredictable. But that's my best guess.
Wow, that's interesting. I thought it was a lot simpler than that, and I had a mystery.
Yeah, I don't think it's the battery itself doing a charge or non-charge. Though, batteries are pretty interesting chemical devices, right? You've got an actual chemical change that's happening in the battery, you've got free ions moving around through the battery, and it is possible for some batteries, most of them have really small cells, but for some batteries to actually produce a bit of a chemical barrier where all of the open anode is closed up by the cathode part. And in that case, sometimes they normally talk about a battery having a memory at this state, where if you move the cathode component back and forth, you actually build up kind of walls and you get less battery performance.
Yeah.
It is possible for you to have done that kind of accidentally and then all of a sudden to open up a dam, if you will, of that chemical reaction. But I doubt that that's the case. I bet it's a circuitry.
Well, that's an interesting idea, too. That's cool. The physical level.
John, thank you for the call. Did you have anything else?
Yeah, actually, I do. What do you think of the idea of building every new house with some kind of battery system so that all this so-called extra power from wind and stuff that's supposed to be variable, sometimes producing too much, would actually go into each house storing it? And houses actually would always be drawing off of batteries.
Well,
there never would be these ideas of overstraining the system. Each house would be running on its own.
Miles kind of touched upon this earlier. We were talking kind of jokingly about taking the wind and then transferring it to heat, and then or taking the wind, transferring to electricity, transferring that to electricity
sodium, yeah.
Yeah, to sodium, getting to heat. Every time you do kind of a storage medium change, you have loss. You have energy loss. Like I was talking about, your battery being charged is actually going to heat up your battery and your computer. That heat is actually wasted power, right? That's normally where the wasted power comes from. So if you were to have add batteries to everybody's homes and run it, the benefit would be that when the power goes out, everybody would still have power. But you'd actually have a whole bunch of loss heating those batteries. So you'd actually be wasting energy to do that system.
Oh, wow. Tons of it, too.
Yeah. Now, if you had solar panels in everybody's homes and then you're all of a sudden using the sun energy to do the batteries, then you're probably in a net gain. But you've got to think of the infrastructure. Making all those batteries, making all those photovoltaics is actually an energy drain on our resources in general. John, thank you so much for the call.
You guys are sharp, and thanks. And you guys are way better than Science Friday, in my opinion.
Hey, thanks. That's awesome.
Wow. That's high praise.
Thanks, John. Let's go ahead and go to Coralitas. Carolyn, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Oh, hi. Boy, I'm a big fan of you guys.
Thanks.
Here's my problem. I have a PowerBook G4, and I got some more RAM put in, but it would be too expensive to put in some more memory. And when we got the RAM put in, they said that I've got some iMovies that are taking up a lot of space.
Mm-hmm.
So I've tried to copy the iMovie onto the external drive.
Ah, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but when I do, it says, it looks like it's going, everything's going fine, and all of a sudden this message comes up at the end. It says, the disk may be locked, read only, or completely full. Try saving to a different location.
Okay, well, one thing is that you might not have enough space to move your iMovies to the USB hard drive. The external hard drive. So do you have a lot of space on the external hard drive?
Yeah, we've got 359 gigabytes.
359 gigabytes. Okay, yeah, not lots of space. You're not going to have that on your G4
no.
PowerBook. Okay, so I would assume that most likely one of the files in the iMovie is actually locked or has a problem. Miles, Alex, you think that's right?
Yeah, have you tried rebooting your
laptop?
Yeah, your G4 after not just closing the lid, but actually going to the Apple and doing a restart.
Do you shut it down sometimes and restart it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So the other thing you can do under Applications, in the Applications folder, under Utilities, is the thing called Disk Utility. And that will do a repair permissions, which is actually a file-by-file look at your entire system trying to fix locked and incorrect settings. It's very possible that that's the problem, and that thing will actually fix it. I've seen that especially in older versions of OS X. Are you running OS X?
I have no idea.
Probably are.
G4 PowerBook, yeah.
I think so.
Yeah.
You're good. So the other thing to do is you might want to move the files, move the movies independently. I think it's a package,
each clip,
actually.
You mean?
Yeah, not necessarily each clip, but there should be a package for try to find out what the actual file that has a problem. It's possible you have a corrupted file in there.
Okay.
But try the utility disk permissions thing.
Now, how do I find the utility?
Under the folder Applications. Open that in your Finder.
Oh,
and then
okay.
Applications is a folder called Utilities, and in there there's a thing called Disk Utility.
Disk Utility, yeah.
And when you when you open a Disk Utility, just select your main hard drive and say Repair Permissions, and you should be set.
And let me ask you a quick question. With the external hard drive, is this one that has been used and is written to, or has been written to by this Mac before, or is this?
Yes, I can. One of my smaller ones. No, not one of my smaller ones. For one of my movies, I didn't have that many clips in there, so I just individually moved each clip over, and that worked.
Hmm. Okay.
When I took them out of the iMovie.
You guys, I don't know if Alex and Miles, if you're familiar with iMovie, especially the earlier versions, they collect the entire project as a package file.
Yeah.
And so even though you've got one file, you've got tons of files inside it, and that might not be transparent to a user. So it can get complicated.
The file format to the USB drive.
Maybe can't handle that size?
No, I'm talking about like VFAT,
whether or not it's a file name issue. You should use that. Okay, so there's one more thing that you should probably do.
Okay.
And maybe it's too late, but when you run Disk Utility, take a look at your external hard drive. Don't erase it or anything, but select it, and it will tell you the file format of that. And if it's FAT32, there was a problem with Final Cut for this, Miles, but I'm not sure if it's true for iMovie. FAT32 is a Windows-compatible hard drive space. Normally, when you get a hard drive, that's the format it comes in because it's more generic. Mm-hmm. That might not be able to take the meta information, extra information that the computer needs to know about your files, and be able to store it effectively on that file format. That's been repaired in newer versions of iMovie and such, but it's possible that's the thing you're running into. And that's the case, you've got to erase your hard drive and reformat it in a Macintosh file system. I wouldn't do that. I would edit those movies, burn a DVD, and get rid of them because it's going to save you time and energy over the long run.
Yeah, I'm not sure that when I've tried before to burn the movies, mm-hmm. I haven't had enough memory to do that.
Okay, so there is a couple things going on. You're talking about memory and RAM. There are two types of storage or memory, if you will, on a computer. There's long-term storage, which is hard drive space, and there's RAM. You can increase the RAM in your laptop. It sounds like you did. You can actually also increase the hard drive space on your laptop by putting in a new hard drive, but that's more expensive. An external hard drive normally makes sense. Keeping in mind, though, that laptop hard drive, a G4 laptop hard drive, it's going to break soon. You know, it's a little tiny, delicate, spinning thing with high speeds and little aerodynamics and... It's just a matter of time for it to crash and burn.
Never mind.
What?
I was going to say it's not that high a speed. I still have my PowerBook G4.
You wish it was high speed. Keep in mind your hard drive will fail, so make sure you got copies of your stuff somewhere else.
Okay.
Good luck.
Thank you,
Carolyn,
so much.
Thanks for calling.
Bye.
Carolyn from Corlitas. Well, we've got three more minutes on this wonderful show today, and there's no crazy USB of the week. I know that that's sad and depressing. I could play an old one, but I'm not going to. Let's go ahead and do let's go ahead and take one more call.
Actually, I can talk about a quick crazy USB of the week from Miles. This was from TAM8. It was a demonstration that was being done for us. They handed out these wonderful little USB drives of all the items that were recovering from the James Randi Educational Foundation.
Okay.
And it was a 2 gigabyte little thumb drive, really small. And one of the guys came up and said, hey, this is actually a gender detector. And they had someone who wasn't involved in it come out of the audience and hold on to it and then say, yeah. And you see, when there's a man nearby it, it's going to rotate in a circle. And a guy came up, walked up, and it started rotating in a circle. Then he held it and made it stop moving. Says, now if a woman comes up, it goes straight side to side like a pendulum.
Gender detection.
Right. And a woman comes up, and sure enough, it does that. And the guy who was holding it wasn't part of the gag. And the guy who was running it wasn't, you know, pushing him or like tossing the USB drive in some different direction. It actually turned out to be something called the ideomotor effect.
And because you witnessed this firsthand, right?
Right. Because the person who was holding it saw that a man or a woman was coming up, he subconsciously made it do what he expected it to do. But if he were blindfolded, it wouldn't work.
Thank you very much, Miles. It's a cool story. As I said earlier in the show, Geek Speak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence. The theme song was done by Al Luckow today. If you'd like to participate and share your content with us, we'd love to play your theme song or put your imagery up on geekspeak.org. GeekSpeak is a Creative Commons endeavor, which means that you're welcome to rebroadcast it, reuse it, share it with people, burn disk, whatever you'd like, as long as you keep the accreditation to us. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. We're streaming and podcasting at kusp.org.